Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, my guest today says not long ago our ancestors lived according to changing seasons. They adjusted how they slept, ate, moved, and socialized throughout the year according to the season. Today, we're more disconnected from the natural world than ever. We wake before the sun rises, we go to bed long after it sets, we eat tropical fruits in the dead of winter, exercise in climate-controlled environments, and we connect virtually instead of emotionally. Our lives are frenetic, stressful, and exhausting. So in other words, we're living what my guest calls a chronic summer, and it's killing us. And my guest is Dallas Hartwig. He has a great new book out called The Four Season Solution, the groundbreaking new plan for feeling better, living well, and powering down our always on lives. So Dallas, his name might seem familiar to you. He's the New York Times bestselling co-author of The Whole 30, and it starts with food. He's a sought-after speaker, nutritionist, functional medicine practitioner, and physical therapist who specializes in treating lifestyle-related health issues. And we're going to talk primarily today about his new book, The Four Season Solution. Here's my guest, Dallas Hartwig. Dallas Hartwig, welcome to the show. Pleased to have you today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I want to just dive into a little of your background, because I always love to know how people got where they are today, and your very early days, at least, were led into maybe the way that you think and live today. You thank your parents in the acknowledgements for teaching you the value of the connection to the earth and the seasons. And you begin your book with an introduction to how you were raised in those early years. Would you share some of that with us?
Certainly. So I grew up in my early childhood years in a very unconventional way. I'm Canadian. We lived in Ontario. But we lived in a 100-year-old original homestead, which was essentially a very small log cabin with no electricity and no running water. So we, during the long, cold, dark winters, we heated with wood that we cut off the property. We had oil lamps and candles, and we had one luxurious propane lantern that was kind of our one source of bright artificial light. But in that realm, in that scenario, you can imagine very quickly you start to be influenced by what's going on with the light-dark cycle outside, because there's just not a lot of, you know, electronic and electrical stimulation opportunities. And now we have, of course, you know, smartphones and tablets and internet everywhere, and, you know, totally different world.
Right.
That was my beginning. And that early experience until I was 5 years old really informed my later years. And as many of us do, we ignore the lessons our parents tried to teach us, go wildly astray, suffer some kind of negative consequence,
right,
and often find our way back towards the place that we started from, begrudgingly recognizing the wisdom that our parents had that we didn't recognize or want to admit earlier. And that's been my experience as well.
Yeah, isn't that true? You say somewhat tongue-in-cheek, you often say that you became an accidental author. At your core, you're a scientist, a clinician, a thinker, teacher. So tell us how you became an accidental author, Dallas.
Again, an unconventional path. My academic training is in anatomy and physiology, and I went to grad school for physical therapy. So my background is essentially in how the body works and healthcare, and helping people heal and recover and regain their full function. Alongside that, I always had a personal interest in athletic performance, in performance nutrition, and in kind of health more broadly. And I have some autoimmune disease in members of my family, and I was, as the research nerd scientist that I am, in the mid-2000s, I was doing some research on autoimmunity and new treatments for that, and stumbled across a research paper that drew a direct line between systemic inflammation, meaning activation of the immune system throughout the body, and very specific dietary proteins that we eat. So microscopic molecular components of different foods. And that was never an idea that had occurred to me before. I knew that food affected my gut health. I knew that food affected my athletic performance. For some strange reason, I hadn't connected the dots. And at the time, I was playing high-level volleyball and had a chronic shoulder inflammation that was impeding my athletic performance, and decided if indeed this was something that research showed, that food affected inflammation, maybe I could help to heal the inflammation in my shoulder with diet. And did some personal experimentation that wasn't particularly well-informed. It was really just a personal experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, 6 weeks later, my shoulder pain was completely healed. And it hasn't come back since, and that's now 10-plus years ago.
Yeah.
So I started speaking about food extensively to patients, to friends, to basically anyone who would listen. And I wasn't an academically trained dietitian. But the things that I told people and the ways that I explained it to people, along with my then partner, started to really resonate with people. And we started a seminar series in the Northeastern United States, which then extended to be a national seminar series, which then extended to be an international seminar series. And we did well over 100 full-day seminars on nutrition. And along the way, co-created a program called the Whole 30. And the Whole 30 program, which is now an enormously influential program in kind of the nutrition sphere, at that point was just a harebrained idea to try something extremely rigid parameters for a very short period of time to see what happened. It was an experiment. It was a scientific experiment. And when we shared that with people, it had profound impact on their health and wellness, and on the chronic diseases of all sorts, on mood, on sleep quality, on athletic performance. And we were like, oh, we're on to something here. And the more we spoke, the larger our online community became. And all of a sudden, we had an offer from a publisher that said, hey, would you write a book on this? And we did. We published It Starts With Food in 2012, and then published The Whole 30 in 2015. So the authorship component of my career has really been using books as one additional venue to convey a really important message, and that is food profoundly affects your quality of life,
right?
Perhaps more than you previously anticipated or understood.
Right. And you say that It Starts With Food is really a prequel to the book we're talking about today, The Four Season Solution. So how does it lead into this, the four-season solution? I heard that you played with the ideas around the four-season for a long, long time before that came into book format.
I did, and actually before they really came into focus in my own mind. So the core ideas in the four-season solution have been kicking around in my head since about 2009 or 2010, but really only started to crystallize 2 or 3 years ago in kind of real clarity. In a lot of ways, the reason we titled It Starts With Food that way is because that was our belief at the time. And it's still, you know, largely true that food is of profound importance. Now, it's not the only factor. And in, you know, one of the chapters in the book, I write about sort of maybe I got that slightly wrong and maybe it actually starts
right.
with sleep.
Right.
So this acknowledgement that food is not the whole story, and I think what I learned through educating people on food was that it is profoundly important, and we sometimes overvalue it. We sometimes think it's the whole story instead of just part of the story. So this framework that includes addressing nutrition, the light-dark cycle, which includes sleep, but it's more than just hours spent sleeping, includes movement, and again, that includes exercise, but not just exercise, and includes connection to self, connection to other people, connection to a sense of place, to kind of Mother Earth, and connection to a greater sense of purpose, something kind of larger than ourselves. So all of those pieces are fairly obvious aspects of our, you know, of kind of health and well-being, but I don't see anyone putting those pieces together in a system that really honors our deep natural rhythms and in a way that is consistent with the different factors. So we are familiar with the idea of a mismatch, and a lot of people call it an evolutionary mismatch, where we have modern, nutrient-poor processed foods that are inflammatory or high glycemic index or whatever, that are a mismatch for what our physiology, from what our bodies actually expect. And that mismatch creates a lot of chronic disease creates a lot of inflammation, creates a lot of problems. And I extend that same principle in this book to not just food, but also the light-dark cycle and sleep, movement and exercise, and connection of those four types that I mentioned. So this is conceptually an extension of what I've been kicking around for a long time.
Right.
And
right.
Now just have more clarity on.
Right. And so just share a little of the neuroscience, if you would, behind rhythms, because it makes sense that, you know, if we look at our ancestors, they had a natural rhythm and we've lost that. You say that we're beaten down today by what we consider normal. So what's some of the neuroscience behind rhythms?
Yeah, so that could go a lot of different directions. I'll try to keep it relatively simple.
Right. One of the things that I've read over and over, and I did see it in your book too, people who work night shifts, for example, are much more susceptible to chronic disease. So that's one way that, you know, an unnatural rhythm for us can hinder, get in the way of our life.
Certainly. And you know, in the sleep where I discuss sleep, in the chapter where I discuss sleep, I talk about how the stimulus of either the presence or absence of light and the type of light, whether it is, you know, kind of has more of the blue wavelengths or less of the blue wavelengths, how the timing of that affects the what we call circadian clocks. So all of our cells have, or almost all of our cells, there's a couple of small exceptions, but virtually all of our cells have built-in 24-hour clocks. And those different rhythms can get discoordinated in different body systems, but the perfect and very effective way to coordinate all of those circadian clocks is with consistent light-dark cycles, meaning we go to sleep and we wake up at approximately the same time each day, and we get bright light early on our face, in our eyes, early in the day and throughout the day, and then once the sun has gone down, because that's the trigger for the absence of light that allows that darkness hormone of melatonin to come into play to prepare us for that deeply restorative sleep. Once the sun has gone down, then we make conscious choices to minimize our exposure to light, particularly those blue wavelengths. Because if we don't, the message that our brains get is that it is blue sky, midday, bright lights, we need to be alert, we need to have, you know, kind of all of our systems ready to go at any moment. And that makes it extraordinarily difficult for us to gently ease into deep restorative sleep. So we have the experience often of putting the phone away, turning off the TV, putting the computer away, going into our bedroom and getting to bed, turning up the lights, and then laying there for half an hour, an hour, 2 hours, and being frustrated that we don't either fall asleep easily, we don't stay asleep consistently, or we don't wake up feeling refreshed in the morning. And a lot of that has to do with the dysregulation of that light-dark cycle. So it's more than just number of hours slept. It's also the neurological timing that goes into those systems to coordinate all of those metabolic systems that we easily get dysregulated when we have light from our screens. And not only that, we don't often have enough bright light exposure during the morning and midday because we're inside going to school or working or we're at home. So we lack that bright light exposure as well. So there's a section in the book where I talk about dark days and bright nights, a sort of an inversion of that natural rhythm.
Right, right.
And to your point about shift workers, that's an even further departure from that natural rhythm.
Right, right. A lot of people blame their situation on where they work and how they work. And you share a story in your chapter on moving to the rhythm of James, who was fed up of working for the man, and so he quit. And yet his health deteriorated because his new schedule wasn't any better. Would you just share a little of that story? I think it's a good illustration.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, a lot of us have this fantasy that we could, you know, quit our 9-to-5 and, you know, be an entrepreneur and travel the world and have a flexible schedule, and that was wonderful. And
right.
My experience, and also James's experience, was one that was a little more complicated and stressful than that. And James's experience was of trying to become a social media influencer to have income, multiple different income streams, and he ended up spending an extraordinary amount of time in front of the computer, on his phone, responding to comments, posting content, writing things, and he actually ended up, what I ended up saying is, he ended up, instead of working a 9-to-5, he worked 5-to-9, and that is clearly not progress in terms of normalizing your rhythm. and certainly not in terms of giving yourself more opportunities to move naturally throughout the course of the day, because movement is more than just the 30 or 45 or 60 minutes we spend exercising, if right. indeed we actually exercise.
Right.
So James had a decline in his physical fitness because he was so occupied with trying to become a successful entrepreneur that he actually neglected that aspect, and his health got worse instead of better.
Right, right. So you describe the four-season solution as a blueprint not just for eating better, but for living better. And you talk about the four keys of wellness. Could you touch on each of those for us?
Certainly. So I talk about putting the pieces together. And, I mentioned that we talk about nutrition, that right. we talk about exercise, we talk about sleep, and sometimes we talk about social isolation and loneliness and the value of vulnerability and authentic connections. And we're kind of getting that all of those things matter. But what we are totally forgetting in the modern world is that all of those things were natural expressions of the way we interacted with the environment in our evolutionary past. And that has always and forever had an oscillating component, had a seasonal component. So each of those behaviors, each of those aspects of our fitness work within this seasonal system, and there are different sets of behaviors that are appropriate, so to speak, in each of the seasons. So there's sort of patterns across the course of the year, and I argue that in the same way as we can have mismatch between what our biology expects in terms of food, we can also have mismatches with what our biology expects in terms of light-dark cycle or circadian rhythm, in terms of how we move, and in between those factors, right? Because these are not silos that are isolated from each other. What we eat affects how our metabolism works. How we move affects how our metabolism works, and vice versa. So we have all of these complex interrelationships, and I think that the four-season solution is a way to sensibly integrate all of those things, not because I'm some sort of madman genius, but because I'm simply observing what is inherent in our biological rhythms and in the natural world, and has always been there for as best as we can tell.
Right.
With an opportunity to take all of those pieces and reintegrate them into a system that is still pragmatic and applicable in the modern world, but that honors the rhythms that we've gradually eliminated from our lives to great cost.
Mm. I'm particularly interested, Dallas, in how the Four Seasons solution is an antidote for burnout, because we're seeing mass burnout, in corporate worlds, and not just in corporate worlds, but in maybe stay at home mums even, and people who work from home, as you said, because I'm one of them. We have to work irregular hours sometimes, and. I'll share this because I've run into so many people who've had the same experience. I ran into a situation about a year and a half ago, 2 years maybe, when I'd been sick, and then I couldn't seem to get better, and I realized I was just so burnt out, I couldn't bounce back. And it's very difficult when you get really burnt out, because I think if, a person is fairly competent and fairly accomplished, they just keep going and going, don't even realize they're burning out until it's too late. So how do you think the four-season solution, you describe it as the antidote to burnout, and I'm really interested in that aspect of it, and you had some great ideas in the book, great insight in there.
Well, great question. I think the way that we can understand burnout is the extension of the stress and busyness and long days and short nights and frenetic pace of summertime, right? The burnout feeling is really similar to the feeling that we get at the end of summer, where we're like, oh, wow, I'm glad to see the days are getting a little bit shorter. I'm glad that the kids are going back to school, that we're not traveling as much, that I can just sort of settle down and be home a little bit more, because we recognize, like, wow, I'm just kind of tired and overstimulated. And if you crank the dial on that up to 10 or 100, that's the thing that happens over years and decades, because most of our modern society is built around the dopamine and adrenaline and cortisol fueled, those are neurotransmitters and stress hormones that fuel our focus, our motivation, our attention, our productivity and success and cognitive resources, and all of that's a really good thing in an episodic fashion, in a way that is only for part of our cycle. But in the modern world, we're doing chronic summer all of the time, and we never actually go through the rhythms that deeply heal us, that deeply restore us. So burnout then is another way of saying that we're living in a chronic summer. So that matters because chronic summer kind of behaviors over the course of time, chronic summer produces chronic disease. And whether that is, you know, chronic fatigue, thyroid problems, autoimmune disease, insulin resistance and prediabetes and diabetes, certainly contributes to obesity, all sorts of stress-related mental health issues like depression and anxiety and insomnia and obsessive-compulsive disorder. So this whole cacophony of symptoms and of experiences that we call burnout, especially just the plain exhaustion, is a symptom of not oscillating the way that we live. So in reintroducing the restorative, reconnective aspects of the fall and winter seasons, we can not only recover from chronic summer, but we can reintroduce a healing restorative cycle into each successive year for the rest of our lives and not dig ourselves back into that burnout hole.
Right. I love these concepts, Dallas. I really do. I want to talk about four forms of disconnection that you address in the book, because I think they kind of play into this too. You've written that something's not right in our social lives. We're connected to hundreds of friends, yet we feel alone. And I know from researching previous shows that studies show how social media contributes to more people feeling increasingly lonely and depressed and all other kind of maladies. And you discuss this in the Four Seasons Solution. So you talk about four forms of disconnection being self, place, offline community, and purpose. Share some thoughts around, you know, how we spend our time online and how we can eliminate some of these distractions.
Yeah. So something I want to sort of state up front, because it's often misunderstood, when I speak about the use of social media in a way that feels critical, is not because I think that social media or broad, large, and relatively superficial socializing is at all a problem. What it becomes a problem in the same way that the summer sleep schedule becomes a problem when we do it all year round for
Right. Days
on end. So what we have in social media is kind of a sort of a symbol or a placeholder for what summer type socializing would be, because it is large numbers of people, relatively superficial or extremely superficial interactions, very careful, what I call image crafting in terms of telling the story that we want people to hear, and almost completely devoid of real human-to-human, face-to-face touch, vulnerability, authenticity, and just like intimacy in the way that we'd have with really close family, a romantic partner, really close friends. And so I give tremendous credit to Brené Brown for her work on vulnerability and authenticity,
yes,
because she's sort of leading this charge into, like, we need to do things differently here. And what I interpret that she's advocating for is stepping away from the numerous superficial interactions of summer and to be able to reconnect to the things and the people that are most important to us. And, you know, so her research and advocacy for vulnerability is really saying, leaving the summer experience behind, we can move into a more deeply settling, slowing down, more present, more grateful, more deeply connected fall kind of experience. So I write about the pivot to fall in the book, where we talk about leaving chronic summer behind in favor of these healing, restorative connections. And if we don't do that, we stay in this place of chronic stimulation, and we have lots of Facebook friends or Instagram followers, but no one knows us, and we don't feel seen and known. And that is a terrifying, deeply a destabilizing experience for a human, because for all of human history, up until the last few hundred years, or for perhaps only a few dozen years, we lived in close proximity, we had multi-generational households, we had clans and families and extended family around, and people knew us because we were always there. So privacy was a real, was a rare thing, but so was loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of come and go together. And we have placed such a premium on privacy in this culture, but what comes comes with that is the isolation and loneliness. And I argue in the book that we need to reinvest in our anchor connections, the people who are kind of our inner circle, because we often turn away from even those people, from our partners and from our closest family and friends. Mm. So reconnecting in that way that feels like falls, belonging and community. In North America, of course, we have the Thanksgiving celebration, which is being present, caring about people that are closest to you, valuing them, being grateful, being generous, and that sort of a sense of belonging. And that's such a beautiful symbolic fall experience, and that's what we need more of in our lives in general. And that is one of the ways that we can heal the downstream effects of chronic summer and recalibrate our, as I call it, our always on lives.
Right. If we took some of the commercial aspect out of these holidays and went back to that, you know, what they're really all about, which is family, friends, and community. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I've actually seen Brené Brown. I'm fascinated by creativity and how creatives think. And she was on a couple of shows that I watch about creativity. And she said that, you know, in the social media world today, or in the world at large today, it's very easy to get caught up in what other people think. And she pulled out of her purse a little piece of paper and said, I made a list of, I think it was about four people whose opinions she really, truly cares about. And if she gets herself caught up in that, oh my gosh, what are they going to think about me? She pulls out that list and reminds herself, hey, this is all that really matters.
There are not that many people whose perspectives really, truly matter to us.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And you've said, you know, most trends focus on making you look different and act different instead of actually, instead of being different. So you're talking about going within and being more authentic there, right?
Yeah, this is a really a fundamental shift. And it doesn't necessarily on the outside look like doing wildly, radically different things. This is not, you know, turning into a subsistence farmer or abandoning electricity. Like, this is not radical, crazy stuff. This is doing sane, research-supported lifestyle shifts in a coherent, coordinated system while recognizing that we have technology all around us, and I'm not arguing against using that. What I am arguing for is making some specific choices, for example, stepping away from the artificial light, particularly those blue wavelengths. After darkness falls outside, we have much dimmer lights in our homes with candles and oil lamps and things like that, and eliminating the blue light altogether. So it doesn't necessarily mean you have to go to sleep as soon as the sun goes down, but it does mean that you want your in-home experience to feel a lot more like the outside experience, which is a warm, orangey sunset light and then eventual darkness.
Yeah.
There are very practical shifts in there, but they have profound impact when you put them in this system where all of the moving parts are functioning together instead of systems that we're pretending are independent of each other, but are really all tightly interrelated in our own bodies.
Yeah. I always feel, you know, when I've gone camping, and I camp rough, I don't, you know, don't have all the luxury camper things. But when I come back to reality, the lights and the television and everything, it takes me a while to adjust. And I think years ago when I was at school working full time, I had a, you know, stressful management job, and I was also going to school full time. I used to take Thursday nights when I had no school, and I would just have no electricity in the house, just candles. I did have music, just music. And that was so restorative. I think I'm going to go back to doing that one night a week.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful idea. And again, you know, to your point about music, we've had music and dance and expression for as long as we've been human, you know, perhaps longer than we've even had really good language. So music is not something we need to go to kind of steer away from. I would perhaps choose some of the more melodic, relaxing music as opposed to something much more kind of aggressive or staccato in the evening hours. But music can be a beautiful way to be more present, to really get into your senses. And especially as we dim the lights and rely less on our visual sense, we are able to have a much richer experience of other senses, including our auditory sense.
Yeah.
So right. I encourage you to continue to listen to music in the evenings.
Right.
And you think about sort of overlaying this entire model is this concept of expansion and contraction, and the concept for the coming home at the end of day and spending the evening settling down is an experience of contraction. Like your physical world gets smaller, and that's a really good, settling, peaceful, restorative feeling.
Right. Don't have much time left, but I do want to get this in. You have a chapter called Getting Unstuck, and so I want to just touch on anchor points, anchors sound somewhat contradictory to getting unstuck, but you say
right.
It's the absolute starting point for living wilder, more rhythmically attuned lives. So what, talk to us about that, if you would.
Sure. So the reason I included a chapter on anchors is twofold. One is what I realized in doing the research for this book was that most things in biology oscillate, but not everything. So there are some kind of principles that around which everything else oscillates. And in the realm of food, my fundamental idea there is that we should always be eating some version of a nutrient-dense whole foods mix of plant foods and animal foods. And I'm avoiding the packaged foodstuffs and aiming for adequate dietary protein at each meal, and really just focusing on eating more locally and seasonally and sustainably and healthfully. And that looks wildly different in different parts of the world and at different times of the year, but it doesn't have to get enormously complex. So the anchor for food is eat what's available locally. For light, it's literally try to get your light-dark cycle at home and at work to look a lot more like the light-dark cycle outside. So more bright light during the day, less light after dark. Anchor points for movement, which includes exercise, really means make sure you're moving every day in some way. In particular, I think that strength training and functional movement body weight exercises are of particular importance across the course of the year and across the course of our lifetime. And our anchor points for social connection are the most important people in our lives. So we need to really reinvest in those inner circle or Brené Brown's four people so that they are always there for us, because that
right.
gives us a profound sense of belonging and security.
Right. Well, some great information, great insights in the Four Seasons Solution. I'll give the whole title of the book here. It's the Four Seasons Solution, the groundbreaking new plan for feeling better, living well, and powering down our always on lives. And I know listeners can find out much more about you, Dallas, at your website, dallashartwig.com. A final thought you'd like to leave them with today?
I think there's a beautiful opportunity here to leverage all of the scientific research we have and put it into a system that really works without becoming neurotic and obsessive about all of the different health aspects. So this is basically a means to an end to more vibrant living, not just health for the sake of health.
Great. Thank you so much for being with us, Dallas. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
And listeners, again, you can find information about Dallas at dallashartwig.com, the book, The Four Seasons Solution. You can find us at conversationslive.net. We've got more than 700 podcasts and more than 1,200 guest interviews at that same address, conversationslive.net. And we post a new podcast every Wednesday. Until next week, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.